Welcome, Shabda.
Thank you so much, and I feel very honored to have such a distinguished group of listeners.
Well, we have a lot of questions for you, my dear. So before I give you a little history of Shabda, I think what we need to do is the invocation. And so Shabda and I will do the invocation together, and you that are listening, if you will please just breathe with us. So Shabda,
toward
the one,
the perfection of love,
harmony
and beauty,
the only being
united
with all
the illuminated
souls
who form
the
embodiment
of
the master,
the spirit
of guidance.
Bismillah, Rahman, Rahim. We begin in the name of Allah, the most merciful and compassionate. So welcome, everybody. And again, we are recording, so if you can mute your phones at a *6, that would be great. I think most of you know Pir Shabda Khan. But just here's some background that you may not know. He's been a disciple of Sufism since 1969. He's a direct disciple of Murshid Samuel Lewis, the Sufi Ahmed Murid Chisti. And if I say anything wrong, Shabda, correct me, please. He's worked closely with a great American mystic, Joe Miller. Shabda is currently the spiritual director of the Sufi Ruhaniyat International and the director of the Shisti Sabri School of Music. He's also a disciple of the illustrious Tibetan Buddhist master, the 12th Thai Situpa Rinpoche. How would you say that?
You're good. Keep going.
I'm going okay. He spent 24 years, and this is since 1972, developing as a vocalist under the living guidance of the late Pandit Pran Nath, the master North Indian classical vocalist who planted the 800-year-old oral transmission of Chisti Sufi vocal music in the Western world. Shabda has appeared in concerts ranging from Visions for a Perfect World to New York's St. John the Divine Cathedral for His Holiness the Dalai Lama, New Music America in Chicago.
Oh, I don't know. They don't need to hear all this part.
They don't need to hear all that. So he's a fabulous musician. We all know that. Shabda travels, you know, throughout the world spreading the Sufi message of love, harmony, and beauty. And he brings warmth, humor, and clarity to his efforts to help seekers on their path to awakening. So Shabda, our topic today is, what is Sufism? What is a Sufi? Can you give us a nice answer to that?
I'll do my best. Welcome everyone to the call. And if we were to look carefully, we would see that everybody's actions are based on a wish, a thirst for a happiness, or a thirst that we feel, each of us in our own way. And then there comes a time in a human being's life when they realize that that search for happiness won't be satisfied by the outside world, that it'll only be satisfied by awakening to your true nature, to connect with your very self, to see that what you're looking for is your very self. And so that path has been going on, called mysticism, from the beginning of time. Those people who gathered under the banner of mysticism have been called different names at different times in history. In the 10th century, the name Sufi began to be used. Nayyad Khan says exactly, he says, the germ of Sufism is believed to have existed from the beginning of creation. And he goes on to say that he says here, the main Sufi teaching, he says, to overcome beliefs and disbeliefs by self-realization, never to be enslaved by principles. The best moral is love, and praiseworthy is beauty. To merge into the one. He says wisdom is the true religion. He says harmony is in balance, and balance being in reciprocity. He goes on to say, and I think this is, he tries to describe in his words, Hazrat Inayat Khan, who was Murshid Sam Lewis's Sufi teacher, as our lineage comes, he says that the object of creating a family of Sufis, a lineage, he says, is to establish a human family with no consideration of caste, creed, race, nation, or religion. He says differences produce inharmony and cause all the miseries in the world. To spread the wisdom of mysticism of the Sufis, which has been until now a hidden treasure, it being the property of humanity and doesn't belong to a certain race or a certain religion, and to attain to that perfection where mysticism no longer remains a mystery, which relieves the disbeliever from ignorance and the believer from falling victim to hypocrisy. He says to harmonize the East and West through music, and now we could say and dance, mm-hmm. The universal language by an exchange and a revival. So he says all of these things, and so for me personally, my own life followed those principles. There was a certain moment in my teens where I awakened that this life, the purpose of this life is to awaken and to realize your true nature. And then my whole life has been dedicated to that. I wasn't in a Sufi lineage until a few years later. But we're not that concerned with the what you call it, but we wish that all people are on this, you know, awakened to this to relieve suffering and to fulfill our life's destiny. Our Sufi lineage certainly is not a religion. Our own teacher, Murshid Samuel Lewis, like Sri Ramakrishna in India or some of the great masters, he was a living proof that all of the streams all go to the same top of the mountain. I don't know if listeners are aware, but most of them are. I think that Murshid Sam began his path by taking initiation with Hazrat Inayat Khan. He said 6 weeks later, he took initiation with Roshi Nyogen Senzaki, who was the Dharma heir to the first Dharma, the first Zen master to come to the Western world, Shaku Soyen. And so he studied Sufism and Zen side by side all of his adult life. Later, he studied Kabbalah, he studied the Christian mysteries. In the 50s, he met his Hindu guru, Swami Ram Das, or Papa Ram Das, who gave us Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, J.J. Ram. And in each case, all the paths led to the same limitless, awakened heart. And so what was important in Sufism, as he would say, he would quote Al-Ghazali, 11th century Sufi master, Sufism is based on experience, not on philosophy, not on premise. So it's the effort from person to person to communicate the way that each person can awaken the experience of the reality in themselves. So let that be the beginning.
Okay. Thank you so much. Let me just say, Lucinda, who is an illustrious member of the board of Dances of Universal Peace, said, a Sufi is one who says yes to the universe's desire to expand. I like that. So a lot of people have questions about kind of the history. How did Murshid Sam then develop the dances, and how do the dances relate to the Sufi order and to us as Sufis?
Yeah. And I understand when you say Sufi order, you mean Sufi lineage. But just to distinguish, there is a particular lineage named to the Sufi Order International, which is a sister lineage to ours. And I think to distinguish, I don't think you're referring to them. You're saying Sufi lineage.
Uh-huh.
So,
thank you.
We were attracted to, if I speak personally, I was attracted to Murshid Samuel Lewis. I didn't come to him to say, oh, I'm looking for a Sufi master. I'm looking for a being who has wisdom and can help me become a useful being on this planet and awaken to my full potential. And I found that being in Murshid Samuel Lewis. He decided to call himself a Sufi master, or in a lineage of Sufis. He decided to teach under the banner of Sufism.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it was 50, 60 years of that when I had met him. It would have been 50 years, not 60, excuse me. And so he reported to he was trying to, here's what I would try to encapsulate. A mystic will want to work on developing strength and courage, kindness and compassion, tolerance and forgiveness, and the ability to be in tune with the infinite. And then lineages carry practices and methods that help to awaken those things. And I think in the West we don't appreciate lineage enough. In the East it's very much appreciated. And it would be simple to say if this call, on this call, we were assigned to develop a lineage of what human beings could eat. And then I would say to everyone, let's take a 15-minute break, walk outside, find something on the ground to eat, and eat it, and come back and report to us. Because we wouldn't have any knowledge of what to eat. Now you could understand how important it is that we have a lineage of what's healthy to eat. And that keeps changing. So lineages carry an approach to awakening. And that's how I see this Sufi family and this Sufi lineage. And so Murshid was teaching us the mysticism of breath, very much the mysticism of walk, recitation of the divine name, attitude. And then he started having visions of people holding hands and reciting sacred phrases and moving together, chanting. And he came and said, I've had these visions, let's give it a try. And we went down to his basement in the Mentor Garden. Many of you have been to the Mentor Garden. At that time, that room wasn't fixed up. It was a two-car garage, you know, where the two cars would be not next to each other, but front to back. So it would be a long and skinny room. And there's just to describe it so you have a feel for it, there was, it was like a garage, so there was no, it was just the struts of the wall, concrete floor, big oil stain in the middle, and, you know, 10, 15 people at the most, Allah, 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 chanting, holding hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how the dances began, and much to the surprise of many of the people in this dance family, he called them Sufi dancing. He named them Sufi dancing, and that's what they were called for many, many years. And, you know, it started out with one and two dances, and then a Ram Nam dance came, and so then there was a dance on Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And they kept expanding to embrace the universality of religious ideals, so that we took advantage or use of all the great tools from all the world's religions. Not in a religious way and not with necessarily the idea of having cultural exchange, or, but really to awaken to our true nature through the use of these great tools that all of the prophets brought. And it wasn't until, I think, a decade later, or someone would give me more accurate, I think maybe 81, 82, where our dear colleague Murshid Sadi, or Sadi at the time, wasn't there Murshid at that time, on retreat had a vision that it would be wise for the dissemination of this form to start the Center for the Dances. We tried slowly to change the name from Sufi dancing to Dances of Universal Peace because, as it is today, and it was then, the word Sufi is always misunderstood. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. Hazrat Inayat Khan had a disciple who was a very close friend of Murshid Sam's named Shamsher or Bryn Bjors. I think he was Scandinavian, and we met him the last few years of his life. Very, very bright light, scientist. And he went to Inayat Khan and he said, Murshid, he said, we should change our name because people so misunderstand who we are when they call us Sufi.
Uh-huh.
And Hazrat Inayat Khan said to him, Shamsher, you're so right. He says, but if we change it, they'll just call us something worse. So he kept the name Sufi, and we've kept the name Sufi. And you can see it does get misunderstood. So in any case, because of that, Murshid had written about the dances, and in one of his writings he'd used the phrase Dances of Universal Peace. This is a decade after his passing. So during his lifetime, Sufi dancing, you know, the flyer said, come to Sufi dancing. But later we found his reference to the activities and called them the Dances of Universal Peace. And then we decided, let's try to change the paradigm and use this name because it will be more accurately understood. In my heart and in my mind, Sufi dancing, Dances of Universal Peace, exactly the same thing. It's not like getting away from something. It was trying to describe something in the language of the listener so the listener would understand what it was better. But no difference. And so it was in the 80s when we started using Dances of Universal Peace, and the Center for the Dances started. So I'll stop there and see what the next question is.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that Murshid Samuel Lewis said, Pir Vilayat is the father of these dances, I am the mother. And in his poem, Siva Siva, he said, the watcher...
Shiva,
thank you. The watcher is the prayerful devotee, but the dancer becomes divine. So,
you know what he did say? He said, and at this time he was using the word dances, a universal beast. He says, Sufi dancing, excuse me. He said, watching Sufi dancing is like watching somebody read a book. You don't get it. the reason he was very generous about naming Pir Vilayat the father of the dances. But what had happened is in 1968, Pir Vilayat came to America for the first time and to the West Coast. And Pir Vilayat is the son of Hazrat Inayat Khan, Murshid Sam's teacher, and. Without going into all the politics that had happened in the different Sufi streams and the different countries, this was an opportunity for the two of them to join forces and work together. Mm-hmm. And Pir Vilayat came to the Mentor Garden, and then he talked about the dance of the Sufis in a very romantic way and in a way that's something that happened in the past.
Uh-huh.
And then Murshid, that lit a light in Murshid, and he thought, well, we could do that right now. That's not in the past. Let's do it now. And then these visions started happening. And so it was through this spark that was provided by the great Sufis of the past who danced, you know. That spark lit up in Murshid's heart, and visions came, and that's how the dances started. So it was also his effort, I think, to unite or bring Pir Vilayat along on the journey of the dances.
So it was kind of referring to the Mevlana order of the dervishes, right? He kind of giving them.
I don't know if that, I wouldn't limit it to that, no.
Uh-huh.
I think I wouldn't limit it to the Mevlevis, but certainly the Mevlevis or Mevlana order, however you would like to call it, are most clearly the use of very formal form of dance in their devotions and in their spiritual practice. But you know, it's all over the world, and Pir Vilayat had traveled all over the world. I'm sure he'd met the Sufis dancing in India as well and different countries. So I wouldn't want to say that I would limit it to the Mevlevi order. Yes, they certainly would be included.
So, you know, Shabda, in just, again, kind of filling out the history, how does Ruth St. Denis tie into this?
So what I understood from Murshid is that let's start at the earlier. When Hazrat Inayat Khan first came to America in 1910, he came with his brothers and his cousin, and they were the Royal Hindustani Musicians, and they were the first Indian classical musicians to come to the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
And where musicians in India were really like royalty and treated with as the jewels of the land, you know, it was a little different atmosphere here in America. They were also dark-skinned, and sometimes they couldn't use the regular toilets. They were segregated, and they met with quite a different atmosphere. But there was a young dancer who had become famous, interpretive dancer named Ruth St. Denis. And she heard about these musicians, and she was performing in Santa Barbara and different places, and she invited them to perform with her. So she would dance. They would play in the what you would call the intermission, in the middle part, and then she would dance again. And so this was one of the income streams for the Royal Hindustani musicians, and that's the beginning of the connection of Ruth St. Denis with our Sufi streams.
Uh-huh.
And then, like I said, Murshid Sam was a few years later had become a disciple of Sufism. He knew about this. He heard about Ruth St. Denis, and he sought her out. And he may have even taken some dance instructions from her as she got in her older years.
Uh-huh.
And he used to quote. He used to call her Mataji. He said, "Mataji, I'm going to teach little children how to walk." And then she would say, "Got it, Sam. You've got it." So, in that way, she inspired into his heart that dance was a sacred form and a way of practicing heart and being beneficial. So she wasn't around when these dances were formed. It's just that she played a major part in his heart, in his love of the dance. You know, he also studied folk dancing, and there were so many elements that went into these dances taking birth.
Yeah. That's fascinating. It's interesting to hear all this history, and especially from you, because you were really involved in that early on.
Thank you.
So there's some questions that have come that this is a question from a budding dance leader who is not a Sufi initiate and didn't feel qualified to lead anything in Arabic. She wanted to know what she can do and why.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you for the question. And, it is interesting that the question arose, well, am I okay leading dances in Arabic? Why isn't the question, is it okay for me to lead dances in any language? Someone who's first of all, these dances are simple, And it's wonderful that someone can begin leading them in an area, even having just touched on them, and learn as they go.
Mm-hmm.
But in the sense of being an accomplished dance leader, you want to have a direct experience through any sacred phrase you use in any language. And especially since we are now, when we lead in a particular language or from a particular religious stream, we now are our spokespeople for that. And if we have a very limited knowledge, those people from that religion, when they're around, will feel this is really very dilettante and not very deep, and these people don't know what they're doing. They're just skirting the surface. So
yeah.
I would imagine her question follows that. I want to be deep in what I'm leading, but I would suggest to her, become deep in everything, in every language that you're going to lead. And then I'd have to ask her, how come the question centered around Arabic and not about Greek or Latin or Sanskrit, you know, or the Tibetan form of Sanskrit or and so on and so forth of the different languages that the dancers are in.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to become someone who has a deep knowledge of every phrase I'm going to use, that I understand it from its meaning, its place in language, its etymology, its place in practice, and how it's used as a spiritual practice in each tradition that comes from, and
mm-hmm.
then bring it into the dance. And so it's why that's Murshid, when these dances were happening, and they brought so many people into the path because they're
mm-hmm.
so beautiful, so full of joy. And he said to us clearly, he says, these dances were given me for the world. We don't want to own them or corral them. And so out of that, we tried to develop a method of training or an approach to training that was very open, that wasn't limiting. It should be known that before the Center for the Dances of Universal Peace started and, quote, dance trainings happened, the way you learned how to lead dance was by example.
Right.
I was with Murshid. I saw him lead them. I understood the place that as best I could that he was leading from his wisdom body, from his experience, how he ran his meeting. I paid attention, and I tried to imitate my teacher and find my own approach. And so I learned by example. Now we have very sophisticated training programs. So many people have developed beautiful booklets and describing the different approaches to leading, what the atmosphere should be like, how to prepare for dances, and so on and so forth. All of that was caught early on, heart to heart. We're very lucky now that people have gone deeply, you know, when they're into the dances, investigated, learned about the Arabic phrases. So I would suggest to the questioner, find someone whose heart they feel comfortable in, whose guidance they feel comfortable with, and study what those phrases mean, when they're appropriate to use, how they should be used, how they fall in the context of where they came from, how they fall in the context of the dance. And now when you speak about it, you can speak about it, I don't want to say with authority, but with a sense of a deep understanding.
From the heart. So the attunement is really important.
Attunement, yeah, thank you. Yeah, very much. I would say both, heart and mind.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you can, if you want to separate them, not that they're separate, but definitely with attunement.
Definitely with attunement.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. So here's another This is a question. It says, the dances have their own organization, but they are really part of Murshid Sam's work, which is what the Ruhaniyat promotes. Some people don't even know this much. Said,
yeah, in so fact, I would say we're, you know, as the peer, I feel entrusted with the responsibility to keep this lineage stream as alive as possible, not to let it crystallize. And so that means to nurture everything that's in our living stream, including the teachings of Hazrat Inayat Khan, mm-hmm. including the teachings of my own teacher, Murshid Samuel Lewis, and then the great teachers who were around him, his teachers, Nyogen Senzaki, Papa Ram Dass, and so on. And so as natural, the dances are one of our primary responsibilities because it's one of the great blessings that he gave into the world. Through that, my predecessor, Moinuddin, worked with his disciple, Saadi, and felt there was wisdom in creating a daughter organization so that organization could have its own board and really concentrate on developing. But it's not like separated and unconnected. It's still in the lineage stream. It's still the daughter of our lineage, and mm-hmm. our lineage is now. I'm responsible for putting in place all of the people who guide the dances. I appoint the guidance council and so on, and all decisions about them go through me. It's one of my primary responsibilities. Something I take to heart and very proud. I don't want to say proud. Take very seriously.
Uh-huh. And probably feel privileged to be working with people like that.
Very privileged.
Yeah.
It's a privilege and a responsibility that. And I'm very pleased with the wonderful people we have in service right now to the dances. So wonderful.
Yeah.
Munir and Darvesha, Farinisa, Halima. If I start naming people, I'm going to forget who it is.
Yeah,
all
I'm
the people.
Just
anyway, and you know the North American board and you know the German Dance Network, and it's just a phenomena, and it's mm-hmm. a phenomena to work with so many different countries and different cultures and different ways of learning and knit them all together and language and translation and finding the way to keep a dance alive and still have its original form, training people in music. You know, I am a musician, and there was a moment in the dances when we needed lots of musicians, and then there was a movement saying, oh, yeah, all you have to do is just tune your guitar in this one key and you just strum up and down and you don't need to do anything. And that works. And if you're a dance leader and you have no musician and mm-hmm. someone just comes and gives you a pitch, that's great. But out of that came a kind of lack, mm-hmm. Lack
of the
need
voice.
To develop as a musician
yeah.
and to bring expertise and beauty into the music. And I think that's been revived now, and a lot of good training in the guitar. Several people have written manuals, same with the drumming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an ongoing process.
Yes, it is. So there are some good questions here about zikr. So here was another comment from a person that goes to the dances. They say, I like dancing with their particular circle, but they said they only do Sufi stuff like zikr, not the dances.
Right. So I wouldn't have called it only do Sufi stuff
yeah.
because all the dances to me are Sufi stuff.
Uh-huh. Good.
So, but I understand the question, but I wouldn't have phrased the question that way.
Right.
And
so I think what
how
she's saying.
But I appreciate the question. So just
yeah.
I wouldn't have said Sufi stuff is only zikr, la ilaha illallah, or Arabic. I practice every morning. I don't only do practices in Arabic. My teacher gave me practices in many different languages, or
uh-huh.
many different religious traditions, if you prefer to call it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then I understand the question, and a dance meeting, as far as I know, is at the discretion of the dance leader.
Uh-huh.
So, certainly you could have a dialogue with the dance leader and say, would it be possible to
maybe integrate.
Do dances from other traditions in other different sacred languages. And, you know, I myself have fallen the other way. I'll lead a meeting which is supposed to be zikr, but then I leak in a Kyrie eleison or a, you know, some other, or a Hebrew, you know, a Ruach dance. And so here I am doing these other dances in an evening that's, quote, supposed to be a zikr evening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I appreciate the question. And
even the sacred phrases in English are, I think,
yeah.
important. So.
Yeah, and we did use a few things in English, but not much when Murshid Sam was alive. And I think there's a great value in bringing the sacred into the English language. And then there's also a great value to appreciate mantric value of the sacred language, especially Sanskrit, Arabic, and Hebrew, where, as an icon said, sound has effect apart from meaning. And
very much so.
We don't feel that the English language was created as much with that in view, that the sounds themselves awaken the heart without their meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that from some of the other sacred languages on the planet. So it's a good time in our history, since English is now becoming the dominant language of the world, to bring the spiritual into it and the sacred into it in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would also say I would shy away from doing a meeting where all the dances were in English.
Uh-huh.
You know, just like the person's question about, it's all the dances are zikr.
Mm-hmm.
So, but those are all personal tastes. And again,
right.
at the discretion of the dance leader. What I would want to say is I want the meeting to have heart and presence and an effort to help relieve suffering and bring joy.
Right. Good. You know, I work with quantum physics, and they're looking at sound as the template for our bodies, even. And
everything's made out of sound.
Hindu.
That's
yeah.
what my name means.
Oh, yeah. All right.
That's
Shabda.
Exactly what the name means. In India, they'll say the whole universe is Shabda.
Okay.
They're
the
not
cosmic
referring
motors
to this person,
now.
Though. Yes, it is.
Great. So here's another question. What is the difference between zikr and dances with zikr phrases?
Yeah, I saw that question. It's a good puzzle.
Can you just give us, you know, a basic meaning of zikr and then kind of
okay,
elaborate
yeah.
a little bit for us?
I will. I'll try to.
Okay.
First of all, it's a difficult word to even translate. So oftentimes it's translated as remembrance, but remembrance means you knew before, and that would discount the meaning of evolution and ever becoming. It does refer, generally speaking, the word zikr refers to the sacred phrase La ilaha illallahu. And this is a very healthy, beautiful, mystical formula that combines the path of negation and the path of affirmation. The first half is a negation, and it's basically saying, overcome your grasping to a false notion of a separate self. That's a confused view. And then in the second half, illallahu, it says, awaken to being in the one, you know, the oneness of being, awaken to the oneness of being. So first you negate, and then you affirm. This isn't it, this is it. And my Tibetan teacher gave a lovely translation. He said, every single relative reality, including everything and not excluding anything, is the manifestation of the incorruptible, unchanged ultimate.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So there it is in Tibetan. He's saying it in Tibetan, though. Here it is in Arabic, La ilaha illallahu. And so generally speaking, anything that employs the zikr phrase and similar phrases like Bismillah, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, the beautiful, you know, Bism Allah, I'll take a few moments to translate this too. Bism, in the sound of Allah. So that's what's basically saying, Bism Allah. Sem like in Hebrew, Shem, in the name of Allah, in the sound of Allah. Or it says, we evoke the direct experience that everything comes out of the One and manifests as Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim. These are the first two beautiful names of God, and they have two roots that they share, Rahma, which means divine love, and Raham, which means womb or container. And so Ya Rahman, so everything comes out of the One and manifests as a boundaryless container of love. This universe is a boundaryless container of love. And Rahim, when the sound has A-E, Rahim, it says that love reaches each and every part of the universe. So it penetrates everything. So it's a boundaryless container of love with that love penetrating every part. So those kinds of phrases are very powerful. They're used all over the world, so they have a rhythm and a blessing in them. And I think if someone were to lead an evening of zikr dances, that would be included. And then if you go around the world, people use these phrases all over the world in so many different ways. Some of the Naqshbandi Sufis, they never even recite. They don't feel reciting is appropriate. They only meditate on the name. Excuse me. Some other Naqshbandis, they'll never dance with the name. They'll only sit and recite. If you go to the Rifais or the Qadiri Sufis, they chant the name, and they do it in a kind of a dance form where their bodies are swaying back and forth. If you go to some places in Africa, Shadaliya, they don't hold hands when they do that. They sit, they stand around together, but then sway together, but not holding hands. You go to Turkey, they'll be holding hands. You go to some countries of very strong practice. You go to India now, which is a more softer place. Now music comes in and there's singing, and then there's a whole tradition of singing the zikr. Mm-hmm. And so it would depend who you asked what zikr is for their opinion according to what they did. And I remember, because I was used to have being in a circle with men and women mixed together and going to Morocco and doing zikr with the Qadiris there, the Qadiri Bouchichia Sufis. And we started by reciting, and we sat in the Zawiya, the meeting hall was like a running couch. There was a place where everybody would sit on the outside, like a couch all the way around the room. And we recited together, but no women there. The women were somewhere else. They did it on their own.
Right.
And I kept looking, where are the women, you know? So that was very uncomfortable for me. But for them, if they came to visit us, they'd go, who?
You got
this
women.
Is different. Yeah, we're, so, you know, I'm sure we've got it right on that one, but whatever, just joking. But so many different approaches. So what's the difference between Zikr, Zikr dancing, Zikr phrases, which is the right way, or are we doing Zikr when we're doing Zikr dances? Okay, well, those are all good questions, and it probably depends on how the person is leading it, and probably the question of the quality of the evening comes from how deep the person who's leading will be taking the group or allowing the group to enter into a deep space. And some approaches to Zikr are very meditative and quiet. And
mm-hmm.
so those people who are used to that would say, well, that's really the deep meditative state of Zikr. But now we might have a Zikr that brings out great joy and embodiment and livingness. And who's to say embodiment and livingness and joy are not as good as quiet meditative state? You know, so it'd be good if our dance leaders were well-versed in every side, and we could create a program that was appropriate for the group and the time and brought balance.
Right.
I'm going to go lead the Sufi youth retreat. Well, I'm going to lean more on the joy and embodiment side than I am on the meditative side, but I will bring the meditative side. Once everyone's engaged and joyful and relaxed and full of ease. But so,
right.
Just a style.
And I think we older folks need that too. A lot more play in our life and a lot more connecting with all the joy.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
I like that.
As well as the meditation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Here's a question. Sky's understanding was that permission to lead Zikr comes from your Sufi guide, but that leading a dance that uses Zikr
she better ask
is
me.
Fine.
I think I've already given her permission.
It's fine for anyone. Is that true?
There's never been I don't believe there's any written policy that says that to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Some Sufi guides may feel that they would like their student who's learning the dance from them to develop up to a certain standard before they led Zikr. So, and that would be their prerogative to do that. So I think that it did become a kind of an idea that got set for a while. I wouldn't want to make it a rule, but I would want to encourage whoever is leading to have depth in what they're leading. And so before you started, it's a very fine line. You know, if you wait till you're really deep, you have to wait a few more lifetimes. So there has to be a place to start. And then if you're in an area where there is no dancing and you want to get started, maybe you just start where you can. So that would be different. You know, there's different reasons to do different things. I like the idea that, A, someone is under guidance, whether it's from a dance mentor or a Sufi guide, and that they have a living, hard connection with that person and a guidance stream. And then there's so much more power, and have the blessing of your teacher say, yes, I want you to go out and do this. You're ready to do this. Why don't you try this? And so I don't know that if someone's asked me, I've answered their question, you know, my own students. So I don't think of it so much as a policy, but something that it's wise to have the support of a guide.
Uh-huh.
Another example, for a while, there was an emphasis in the form of the dance that the right hand should be down and the left hand should be up. Now, this wasn't something that Murshid Sam started. Never discussed at his time. I certainly understand that there's a flow of energy that happens, you know, with the right hand giving and the left hand receiving. But then there became, there were, you know, there were times when they were the hand police. And if you weren't holding hands right, then you'd
right.
get in trouble with the hand police. And quite honestly, there's a something in the dance that I would say would trump this flow of energy left, you know, right down, left up, which is if someone's tall, it's easier if their hands are down and the person who's shorter have their hands up, because oftentimes
uh-huh.
otherwise your wrist feels like it's going to come off. So
right.
It's always good to understand the principle behind something and then make the choice. You know, there might be a dance where you really want to emphasize the form, and then there might be another time where you want to be relaxed about form because you see the people aren't capable of it, and
mm-hmm.
why make them feel incapable.
Right. Just a reminder to some folks, if you aren't muted, if you wouldn't mind muting, it's a star 6 because we're hearing some background. I know the Alauddin has been also, when he does his dances, if people can't do that sweep across the heart when they're working on a zikr, to not worry about it because of their backs and stuff, you know, so.
Oh, yeah. I would say, especially now that a good part of our community is aging, whenever
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of turning in the dance, to right away make a caveat and say, okay, we're going to be turning a lot, but if turning is not healthy for your body, you stand still while we're turning and still participate in the dance and don't feel less than because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we have to become skillful in our leading.
Good. Now, is there anything that you would like to kind of add to pull this together? And if we have a few minutes, we could have a few questions from...
Well, I'd love to have questions, and it's sad for me when I hear, oh, we don't want to be like those Sufis. We want to just do the dance separate. There's no connection, and da-da-da-da-da. Instead of having loving cooperation and friendship and a deeper understanding of what everything is. And so I really want to invite each of us to cherish each other and help each other along this path, oh, no matter where we stand. And we're very proud that there are dance leaders who aren't necessarily Sufi disciples and bring their dances to their churches or to their synagogues or so on and so forth. Let this form go far and wide and be of benefit. So I'd love to have questions, yes.
Okay. So if there's anyone that would like to ask Shabda a question, what you can do again now is hit star 6. And the lines are open.
Hi, this is Hamida in California.
Hi,
and
Hamida. Where California is a big place.
Oh, near Santa Rosa, Forestville, near Sebastopol.
Wonderful.
Anyway, I just wanted to, I thought I got on earlier, but I didn't. Anyway, I missed the time. But I wanted to say something about what I saw when we went to India and did the dances at the Darga, because it showed me that the dances are such a vehicle for the teaching. I saw Hindus, Muslims, Indian people of all types dancing with Americans, Europeans, people of all ages, people of different languages, people of different religions, different social classes, and they were all smiling and united in this kind of it's like the trickster way, you know, of connecting people. It's the coyote way. And it was so powerful. And and in the shadow, in the beam, not the shadow, of Hazrat's Anayat Khan's Dargah. It was such a beautiful thing, and I'm so happy that Shabda brings them all over the world.
Thank you. Yeah, I leave on Wednesday. I go to the UK and then to Russia, and there's a large number of dancers in Russia, really big. I mean, obviously in the UK as well. So, thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question. This is Perry.
Go ahead, Perry.
Shabda, there's a, in circles, each circle has its challenges, I guess, and its beauty. And sometimes we can focus on things like, oh, there's no young people coming to the dance, or, oh, there's no people of color at this dance, or it's hard to sort of, you can borrow trouble, but it's also hard to figure out what really is your work. Like maybe you're not reaching out in a way that, or stretching yourself in a way that you could be. So the question I have is, how do you recommend that as a dance leader, each of us makes herself as wide open to the message that Sam and Anayat Khan have left us versus really maybe not? How do we know when we're not casting the net wide enough?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. My own sense is, from the deepest point of view, are we all still together? You there, Carl?
I think
Jamila?
So. Please,
okay.
Yeah.
I heard all those clicks. My own sense is that we want to become the proof of the lineage, so to say, a living proof, a living example of kindness and compassion, strength, courage, tolerance, forgiveness, and a deep, in tune, being in tune with the infinite. And so I think that very much applies to the dances, to have great musicians. Each of us, like you said, will have different qualities. Some of us will bring musicianship, and so there'll be a lot of music. Some of us will bring a kind of a profound presence, or a deep presence, or a meditative presence, or an appreciation of repetition and that mantric aspect, and so we'll each bring a different atmosphere to our meetings, and then also to recognize that the dances themselves do their work, and in some sense we want to be there to guide them and also, so to say, get out of the way, so it's not done from a controlling aspect but a guiding aspect. And then we have to balance, you know, the question is, do you focus on the positive side? You know, which side do you focus on? And so a good practitioner has a balance between developing strength and courage and going forth and doing what they're being called for, and then at the same time shining a light where there's shadow and confusion and greed and self-loathing and so on, and see what our own shortcomings are. And so if you shine the light on the shadow too much and you don't have enough strength and joy from the positive side, you'll drown. So you have to find a balance between the two. And then same with our dance meetings. We're going to bring our strengths to them and then look and see what it is we can do that's different without blaming the dance meeting for being wrong here, wrong here, wrong here. So just keep finding a balance. And then luckily we've got our organizations to support us, our teachers to support us. So now there's a tremendous library of the dances on the North American site, on the international site. You can study the music, you can watch a video of it. There's help with musicianship. Now there's help with in how to advertise a meeting, how to get the word out, you know. And so, and then we're going to each need to find help too. You know, you want to have a Facebook page, get someone who's good at Facebook, and start using the media to get the word out, so that we reach a different demographic. And at the same time, it's a very mysterious question, Perry, because I know, having led meetings for over 40 years, there's always a kind of an ebb and a flow. They grow, they get big, then they get smaller, then, you know, not everybody has constancy to keep attending the same thing. They want something different. But some of us as leaders, we just stick to it. So, you know, I've had meetings that have been going for 20 years. They grow, they swell, they get smaller, they grow again, they get smaller again. And what I have found that's interesting is, in the past, I might have said big meeting good, small meeting bad, but now I really enjoy some of the small meetings because they go so deep. But I do understand if they get too small, then there's not enough people to make the thing happen. So I hope that's some useful ideas.
You know, and also know that the board has made a commitment to really assist a wider web that encompasses more of the smaller circles around and what is going on with them, which also, you know, might assist the whole process.
Right.
So I think we have time for one more question, and then Shabda will need to close this session.
Very good.
One more question from anybody? Or comment? Okay, Shabda, thank you so much for your wisdom and your light. And we greatly appreciate you guiding us and giving us some history so that we really understand better where we're coming from as dance leaders and dancers and dancing the light across the world. Thank you so much.
And I send my love and encouragement and blessing to, naturally to all sentient beings, but now in this context, especially to those people who have felt the call to carry these dances as part of their life and to lead them, and encourage you to become a proof of the dances and become have mastery in every phrase you're going to present, and start where you are, but develop your music skills, develop your rhythmic understanding, develop your understanding of pitches, develop your understanding of the meaning of phrases, why it would be good to use this dance now and that dance now. Have a healthy relationship with the guide. I think it's very, very, we're really trying to change the culture of the dance, dance training from, you know, okay, I pick a mentor, I go for 3 years, got my certificate, see you later, to a culture where, yes, it's good to take a training and get certified, but really to keep a living relationship with a mentor, so that you don't fall into the dangerous zone of working on your own and not keeping a check on your activities. And, you know, in all the fields like psychology, psychiatry, and so on, you always have to have a checkpoint, you know, someone, different names in different fields. But so have a living relationship, have someone you appreciate and trust who you can show your most beautiful side and your most difficult side to, and be open to their guidance. And if you're with a mentor that doesn't suit you, there are other people. Find another one. But find someone you can be with so you can in a stream of guidance. And I send my blessings to everyone carrying on this lineage together, and may it help relieve suffering and bring real deep and profound joy and awakening to all sentient beings who come in contact with it. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Okay. Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. Okay, everyone. Ya fatah.
Thank you, Shabda.
Ya fatah.
Ya fatah to you.
Ya fatah.
Bye, ya fatah.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, bye.